Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Canberra, Australia, and Wellington, New Zealand. I'm Henry in Sydney. And we also welcome our correspondent in Ireland, Declan Hughes, who is in Dublin from 103.2 Dublin City FM. Welcome.
Good to be back, Henry.
Right. You know, I was just thinking, you know, just to let our regular listeners know that we're both born in 62, we're both the same age. I want to talk a bit about our hometown of Dublin. And what intrigues me is that despite the fact that we grew up in that city, being Protestant as I am or was, and I'm guessing you were brought up Catholic, we really did live in different worlds, didn't we?
To an extent, except for the fact that when I was 9 years of age, my best friend was Protestant. So I had interaction with the Protestant world, so to speak.
Yeah.
Which was unusual, because for our listeners who might be familiar with, is that in the Republic of Ireland that you and I grew up in, I think Protestants were somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
Now, it had been a lot higher, and in fact, when the state was founded in 1921, I think it was as high as 15 or 20%. And what happened was a combination of some people left the newly fledgling free state for political reasons. They saw their allegiance as being to Britain. Some of them moved to Northern Ireland. Some of them moved to mainland Britain. Some, to be fair, were kind of had reprisals practiced against them because of the actions of the British, and were forced out of where they were living, which was appalling and an abomination. But nevertheless, that's kind of how oppressed people sometimes react. They pick the wrong members of who they perceive to be the enemy and victimize them. And also the fact that Protestants tended to have smaller families meant that the Protestant population dropped to the levels they're at now. In fact, ironically, the Methodist community in this country experienced its first growth in population in the late 1990s with an influx of Methodists from West Africa and other places like that, when immigration started in earnest in the Republic of Ireland. And it was the first time the Methodist churches had been full since probably since British rule.
How interesting. I was brought up Presbyterian, which I think those here in Australia, they've merged with it's gone straight out of my mind now, Methodists. And Presbyterians, they merged them.
Very strong in Northeast Ulster. In fact, the Presbyterians would be the biggest religious grouping in Northern Ireland. There'd be a good 500,000 Presbyterians in Northern Ireland, easily.
Yeah, I want to ask about, you know, we're going to just have a brief chat about the history of Dublin. In 1988, they had the millennium, 1,000 years. And interestingly enough, and I remember that, but I had actually left Ireland at this point. I left in 87. But you know what's interesting? Sydney had its bicentennial in 1988. So that's 200 years. And it's now 234 years old. Dublin has a rich history, doesn't it, Declan?
Dublin certainly does. To people outside of the Irish sphere, the term Dublin is a corruption of the Irish Dublin, which means Blackpool. And the original Blackpool is on the south bank of the Liffey, up near where the Ringsend power station is now.
Oh yes.
And there was a settlement there originally. And Balla Ochlea, which has become the Irish name for the city of Dublin, was a village about maybe a mile and a half or 2 miles upriver from Dublin. And that was the first settlement. And that, again, was also on the south side of the river, but it was, you know, a good distance upriver from the Blackpool. But eventually the two settlements became one, and the Dublin name tended to be the one that the Vikings corrupted into Dublin. They called it Difflin originally, and it became Dublin when the Anglos arrived.
Where did the Vikings come from?
Norway, mostly. And they came in ships. And they were very good sailors. They would have conquered places like Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and they also the Swedish branch of the Vikings went inland. They went to places like Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. They went downriver. They conquered Russia, and they had huge territorial gains, which the Swedes actually several hundred years later, in conjunction with the Lithuanians, had large portions of what we now know as Eastern Europe under their sway. In fact, as I may have explained to you on a previous occasion, it's the reason why the Ukrainians are so different from the Russians is the Ukrainians lived under Polish-Lithuanian rule for 400 years, and that's why they're all Roman Catholics, and their neighbors next door are all Russian Orthodox. And that was a period of like Lithuania was an empire. This is something people can't get their head around. They look at the size of it now and they say, God, they're such a tiny country. Yeah, well, Lithuania was, in the 14th and 15th century, an empire.
It's interesting because Northern Europe, you know, those countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and you said particularly Norway, it was kind of with the Vikings, that was the superpower of the time, was it not?
Yeah, it is estimated that, you know, St. Brendan reached America. And in fact, the reason we know that St. Brendan reached America, North America in particular, is that legendarily, several hundred years ago, we're talking like, you know, 900 around then, we had knowledge of a place which was referred to as Tolvanesh, which means the land of the fish. We since discovered that is Newfoundland. So it means that Irish-speaking people had found Newfoundland before 1000 AD.
So if the Vikings, you know, sort of went to Ireland, who was in Ireland at the time?
There was a mixture of people. There was a tribe called the Fir Bolgs, who were dark-skinned people with brown eyes and black hair. And you still see traces of them in Ireland today.
They call them the Black Irish, is that right?
Well, a little bit, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were the Irish, they were the native Irish that got suntans, basically. the Vikings are responsible for the red hair, by the way.
Oh.
Yeah. There was no red hair in Ireland when the Vikings arrived. And also, red haired people make up about 4% of the population. However, a further 10% of the population carry the red hair gene. So they have brown hair, but they've all the other aspects of red hair, i.e. pale skin, needing to put factor 60 on to open the fridge door, that kind of thing, you know.
It's fascinating to hear, you know, the history of our own city. Now, I want to talk about... Sorry.
The reason why all of these are in the modern Gaelic language is because the predominant tribe that invaded us, we had lots of invasions, but the predominant tribe that invaded us were the Celts. And they became the biggest cultural influence on the Irish people. We are actually a cultural hodgepodge, but the biggest influence is the Celts. And when the Celtic Irish spread our culture to other parts of these islands, so to speak, the Scottish Gaelic language is a branch of Irish Gaelic. And in fact, it's very close to Ulster Irish. Manx is related to our form of Irish as well. Now, there's another branch of the Celtic languages, which is spoken in Brittany, Breton. The ancient Cornish language would be part of this branch, and Welsh, they would be part of the second branch. And the way to know the difference between the two branches of the Celtic languages are the southern Celts, as I call them, the Welsh, the Cornish, and the Bretons, they're known as P-Celts, and we're known as C-Celts. So we would have, for example, the Irish name for a head is a cian. The Welsh name for a head is pen. That's a brilliant example of it, right?
Yeah.
So the ending is similar, but the phonetic that starts it is radically different. So Penman Mawr in Wales, for example, would be a headland.
These languages are quite similar, aren't they? Scottish Gaelic and Irish Gaelic and Welsh Gaelic.
In fact, just to illustrate the point, there is a Scottish language version of Channel 4, and there's BBC Alba, which are in Scottish Gaelic. We have an Irish television channel, an Irish language television channel here called TG Cahir, whose sports output is absolutely phenomenally good. It's so good that people who don't have a word of Irish are watching rugby on TG Cahir because the coverage is so good.
That's great.
To get back to the point I was trying to make is, there was a very funny comedy set in a crematorium called See You Burn, commissioned by TG4, the Irish language channel. And they were able to sell it successfully in Scotland with a few little subtitles, and it took off like a house on fire.
Gosh.
Because See You Burn was filmed in Donegal, right? So they just put in titles for the couple of words that they wouldn't understand. But the Irish is very, very similar.
You broadcast in Irish, don't you, in Gaelic?
I co-host a half-hour show with a remarkable young man in his 20s called Andrew. And Andrew's previous co-host was a man of my age bracket. He was in his early 60s. He was a retired teacher. And what happened was there's a chronic shortage of substitute teachers in Ireland at the moment, and he now is earning a living as a stand-in teacher for women on maternity leave in the secondary school system. He's gone back to, because he's Irish, so he now gets 3, 4, 5, 6 months work every year, and because of that he wasn't able to commit to the program anymore. The program used to go out live on a Monday afternoon. Andrew used to work in McDonald's and had Mondays off. Andrew has since got a proper job. And I'll be recording my Irish show with him at 8 o'clock tonight, as soon as I come off the air, having done my soccer show.
And tell me, what is the listener? I know it's hard to gauge listenership in this day and age because there's so many mediums, the whole media world is split because of so many places people can go to get media. Have you any idea? I'm just intrigued about people, about a show in Gaelic. And I'm wondering if young people, if there's an upturn of interest, because I know back in the 70s when we were in school, I just didn't do the Irish language and the teacher just gave up on me. But there seems to be a resurgence amongst young people, and I'm wondering what your listenership is like. And is it fair to say that there's a resurgence?
Figures for the Irish language show, because the only show we have audited figures for is the traffic show that goes out from 7 to 10 in the morning and from 4 to 7 in the evening. It's called Live Drive. It is our biggest flag-bearing show. It's sponsored by the City Council, and they pay for the staffing of the show, and they also pay for the audience research, because this radio station couldn't afford to do it without them.
Right.
And we commissioned a company called Kantar to do listenership figures. Now, what Kantar have done is they do a test on the peak listenership, and they leave the test material running for about an hour and a half or 2 hours afterwards. And that's how I have an estimate of what my listenership is for my soccer show on a Monday night, which goes straight out after the traffic program.
Right.
And the last time I had audited figures for this, Henry, was in about 10 years ago when the traffic show had a peak listenership of 130,000. It's now double that. They estimated the peak hour for listenership to the traffic show was 5 to 6. And they said that at 7:05, which was an hour and 5 minutes later, 50% of the peak listenership were still listening. That's when I'm on the air. So I have roughly 50% of the peak listenership of the traffic show as a captive audience, plus people who tune in specifically to hear me and the gang talk soccer. So my listenership figures are well over six, are well into six figures for the soccer show, but I don't have audited figures for the Irish language program because it goes out in the mid-afternoon. It goes out about, I think it's 1:30 to 2 on a Tuesday when we go out now.
To where I can be on my own. I wanted to see you, and now that I have, I just wanna be left alone. I'll always remember your kind words, and I'll still remember your name. But I've seen you changing and turning, and I know that things just won't be the same. And the lippies that stank like hell, and the young people walking on Grafton Street, everyone looking so well. I
If you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia, and I'm talking with Declan Hughes in Dublin, Ireland. This World Cup, it started off badly. How's it continuing?
Well, it's an interesting tournament for a variety of reasons. I mean, the questions about why Qatar, of all places, a small country protruding into the Gulf of Persia, I think it's called the Persian Gulf, of all the places in the world to put it, Qatar was completely unsuitable. Never mind the issues relating to the way the regime behaves towards migrant workers, for example.
Yes.
There were 8 or 9 new stadia built for this tournament, and they reckon the death toll among the workforce that was used to build these stadia is somewhere in the region of 6,500. So 6,500 people are dead just so this World Cup can go ahead.
Jesus.
That's the first issue. The second issue is the conditions under which these migrant workers, most of whom came from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Ceylon, and other countries like that, Vietnam, those kind of places, places where the average standard of living would be pretty basic, pretty poor. These guys were working on the same basis that Irish workers used to go and work abroad years ago and send money back to their families. I don't know if you remember the term remittances, Henry, but a lot of these countries, they rely on the men going abroad to earn a living. And they live in appalling conditions, and they live on small rations, and they work every hour that can be sent to them. And they save as much money up as possible to send back home to their wives to keep the children alive, basically. And it really is reminiscent of late 19th century, early 20th century experiences for Irish families. And indeed, other Eastern Europeans had similar experiences. Certainly, the number of the Gastarbeiters that were working in Germany, a lot of them were from Tito's Yugoslavia during the 60s and 70s. And the husbands would go away to work in Frankfurt and send money back to, you know, Mama in Zagreb or Mama in Belgrade, etc., to keep the families afloat. And this practice, I mean, these practices effectively propped up the economies of the countries that the families were living in, like the East Asian countries that I mentioned earlier, are being propped up by some of this money being sent back. And the Irish economy definitely was in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, for sure. And you see it replicated all over the place. And the number of similarities and parallels to Irish history are phenomenal. I mean, I find I'm able to relate to people all over the world because of what I know what happened to my own people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting because this still goes on, you know. A lot of people work in Australia and send their, you know, their wages home to other countries if they're from, you know, countries that are third world countries, I guess. So this is nothing new, is it? I mean, really, it's...
No, I mean, we've had it here with the Philippines people particularly. I mean, with people coming over here, men and women alike, coming over to work in the nursing profession. And their families are back in the Philippines, and you know, they're living here on their own, trying to make a living. In some cases, the women come over; some cases, the men come over. And in fact, in care homes, there's a lot of male Filipino nurses who are looking after the elderly here. And again, what's happening here is nursing is now a degree course in most universities, and kids coming out of university aren't prepared to work for the entry-level wages available to nurses here. So they head to places like Australia, like New Zealand, like the Middle East, where there's no taxes, and so on. And what they tend to do is they rise through the ranks of their profession, and when they eventually do come back to Ireland, they come back as staff nurses and they boss the kids around.
It's an interesting way of doing things, isn't it? I want to get back to the World Cup now because, you know, I just saw, I don't know if this happened while you were asleep in your time, Belgium lost to Morocco and there were street fights in that country, Declan.
Yes, I've actually been watching an item in preparation for this slot with you, Henry, on Euronews.
Yes, I'm familiar with Euronews.
The match happened during my waking hours, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Belgium were abject, incidentally, and Morocco fully deserved the win. Belgium, just to put things in perspective for your viewers who might not be familiar with soccer, the Belgian team is one of the most talented teams that the country's ever produced, and they have reached number one in the FIFA World Rankings on several occasions over the past decade. However, they singly failed to win anything. They haven't won a European Championship, they haven't won a European Nations League, and they singly failed at the World Cup. So this team is led by a very talented man called Eden Hazard as the captain. But their talismanic player, Kevin De Bruyne, plays in the English league with a team called Manchester City. And Kevin De Bruyne was asked during the World Cup, did he think Belgium had a chance of winning it? He says, no, we've no chance, we're too old. He says, our chance to win this tournament was 4 years ago and we blew it. Now, he's come under attack, shall we say, from within his own camp for saying so. But I think Kevin De Bruyne has been proved correct. They were absolutely dismal against Morocco and thoroughly deserved to lose. Now, to put things in context, there's a very heavy immigrant population from Morocco living in Belgium at the moment. And it's the kids who are Belgian-born of Moroccan parentage who took to the streets with Moroccan flags around their things that got involved in the rioting and the trouble. And it's disappointing to see, because Belgium has been one of the countries that has been more welcoming to foreign immigrants than perhaps some of the other countries in Europe. Now, there is a far right in Belgium as well. And in fact, it's particularly pronounced among the Flemish-speaking part of the country, which is, if you draw a line through Brussels and everything north of that towards the Dutch border, basically speaks Dutch. That's a simple way of summing it up. Everything south of that line tends to be French-speaking, and there's a pocket over near Luxembourg where there's 250,000 native German speakers. They're native to Belgium, but they speak German. They're a German ethnic minority. So this is another aside. There is an official version of the Belgian national anthem where you sing the one line in Dutch, one line in French, and one line in German, and that goes all the way through. That's the one I want to learn, incidentally. But to get back to the story, so that's how the riots are coming about. And some of the local Belgians are quietly hostile to this whole thing, and with good reason. The business are being destroyed, and so on and so forth. And it's a ridiculous. Like, they won the game, for God's sake. It's not as if they lost. You know, it's over exuberance turning to violence, and it's not necessary.
How do you think the legacy of the World Cup, this World Cup, will go into the future? You know, being held in Qatar and all the dramas surrounding it. Is this? You mentioned earlier on they shouldn't have really been doing this.
No, I mean, one of the big problems is their attitude towards gay rights and stuff like that. There are no gay rights in Qatar. In fact, if you're seen exercising your gay rights, you could be imprisoned or worse. Mm. And this has been a big issue. So at one point, 7 of the nations taking part in the World Cup had decided that their captains were going to wear rainbow armbands. And this was all set to go and seemed to have the approval of the governing body who run the World Cup, namely FIFA. And then at the 11th hour, just about a week before the tournament came out, FIFA came down heavy and said, no armbands. So basically all the countries backed down. Now, Germany, interestingly enough, were playing Saudi Arabia in their first match. And the players posed for the team photograph with their hands over their mouths, more or less saying, we can't express our opinions. They then proceeded to lose 2-1 to Saudi Arabia. So one wonders whether their political stance was up to it. Another act which I thought was very interesting, and as I said to you offline, is a typical millionaire response to this kind of thing, is the captain of England wasn't allowed to wear a rainbow armband. So he wore his rainbow Rolex watch to the next match he played in instead, and was photographed with it, with his arm exposed so everybody could see his Rolex watch that was in the LGBTQ rainbow colours. A very subtle form of protest, but very few people could afford to protest in that manner. The other thing I was going to say was that the Iranian team were very interesting, because they're protesting about the manner in which their government is treating women in particular. None of the teams sang the national anthem of Iran during the first match. And it was a game they lost 6-2 to England. But interestingly enough, in the second match, only some of them sang the national anthem. And they panned to the audience. And a lot of the Iranian supporters were in floods of tears. Now, it's interesting to see, because Iran actually won the second match and were very good value for it. They beat Wales 2-0, incidentally. Before they scored their two goals, they had hit the post twice during the game. Then the Welsh goalkeeper came off his line and an attempt to clear the ball. He just collided with an Iranian player and was deservedly sent off. The Wales substitute goalkeeper had to be brought on. The Wales had to take off an outfield player to compensate for being a man down because that's the way it works. If your man sent off, you can't replace him. But if you're a goalkeeper, you take off an outfield player and you still play with 10 players, but at least you've got a proper goalkeeper. Wales went on to lose the game 2-0 with two goals in lengthy injury time. And that in itself was something, but it just shows there's a lot of issues going on here. The Iranian players are protesting against the actions of their own government, and they're very, very brave to do so. In fact, in another sport, totally out of context, the entire Iranian women's basketball team recently rocked up to a basketball tournament, and none of them were wearing hijabs.
Oh.
And so, like, it's very interesting to see that this level of protest is taking place, and it's taking place, like, they're doing it on foreign soil.
Mm.
Which means that if they go back home and wear the hijabs, there's literally nothing the Iranian government can do about it.
How interesting. I know, as you know, I don't know anything about sport, but I do believe Australia is in the World Cup, and they lost the first match.
They took the lead against France. A very good goal from a lad called Craig Goodwin put Australia one up against France, which, if it had stayed like that, to be fair, would have been one of the biggest shocks in World Cup history. But France are the defending champions, and despite being down three or four world-class players, they have so many others. They have the next man in line to be considered best player in the world. His name is Kylian Mbappe, and I love the fact that he's an Irish first name. But anyway,
yes.
Kylian Mbappe took over the match, basically, and set up goals for his teammates, and he scored one himself. They ended up winning by 4-1. However, in the second match, Australia won their second match with a brilliant header from a chap. I'll just get you his name now in a second. It's gone out of my head. I'm getting old. You do appreciate it. I mean, seeing as we're of a similar vintage. Yes. A brilliant header from Mitchell Duke gave them a 1-0 win over Tunisia. And Australia are now in a position whereby if they can get a positive result in their last game, depending on how results go elsewhere, they could be in the next round.
So they're not out of the possibility of winning the World Cup. Is that right?
Mathematically, they can still do it.
And what do you think? I mean, it's not really our game, is it, soccer?
Not in the World Cup, but they could make the next round.
Yeah,
and once they keep winning matches in the latter rounds, well, anything is possible, you know.
Who do you think is going to? I mean, this is a ridiculous question, of course, but who? I'm just going to ask you anyway. Who do you think is going to win the World Cup? What would you?
On the basis of what I've seen so far, the two best teams I've seen so far are France and, regrettably, Brazil. I don't want to see Brazil win 6 World Cups. They've won 5. They have the highest number so far. Germany have got 4. They don't look like they're going to win the World Cup. Italy have 4, but they aren't even at the tournament. They didn't qualify. And they're the reigning European champions.
That's strange.
That's how difficult it is to qualify for a World Cup these days, Henry. The dice are actually loaded now against European teams.
It's a bit like the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah,
when Eastern Europe opened up and all the countries, Latvia and all those countries, came into the Eurovision Song Contest, it sort of changed the whole dynamics of it, didn't it? And the same with this, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I mean, you are now exposed to Eurovision Song Contest on an annual basis because Australia now takes part.
Yes, we've always watched the Eurovision Song Contest, very popular amongst the viewers to SBS, which is a special broadcasting service, which it's a lot of immigrants like me watch that station because it does foreign movies, all that sort of stuff. And it's always been really popular. Then for some anniversary, they decided to invite Australia to sing. And a guy called Guy Sebastian came second for Australia. And if Australia was to win, it could not be played here, they say, because of time zones. But, you know.
Well, unless you're prepared to start hosting it at 4 in the morning or something, I don't think it'd be feasible.
Yeah, I don't think they can do it. But, you know, it's funny because they said it was one-off the first time, and now we've been in there 4 times. We're there to stay. You know, a bit like Israel, we're not part of Europe.
Well, you see, Israel is part of Europe in terms of they are members of the European Broadcasting Union, and they are also members of the European Football Federation because they can't play in the Asian Football Federation for political reasons.
That's interesting.
Now, the Asian Football Federation is very interesting, and it's very interesting to you because of political issues. And I have to hand it to the Asian Football Federation because Australia is now a member of the Asian Football Federation, incidentally. I'll explain the reason for that to you in a second. The guys running the Asian Football Federation have to cope with the following issues. Games between Pakistan and India can't take place on Pakistani or Indian soil. This is a security nightmare.
Yes, I imagine.
In fact, they can't take place now in any sport. Cricket, you name it. They can't take place on Pakistani or Indian soil. It's too potentially dangerous. Hockey, the works, the whole nine yards.
Gosh.
There are certain states can't play each other for political reasons as well.
Right.
And so what they have to do is they have to find neutral venues where teams can play off against each other. And this is how Qatar came into the reckoning for the World Cup, I reckon.
Yeah.
Because Qatar had been used as a neutral venue to play off matches between nations that would be hostile towards each other. On several occasions and at various different underage levels and of Asian competitions. And they usually have to play off matches. You know, in most continents, like, for example, there's a famous continental competition in South America. The federation is known as the CONMEBOL. And basically, there's only 10 countries in it. They play each other home and away, and that decides who plays in the World Cup. The top four go straight in, and the fifth team goes into a playoff against another continent. Sometimes it's somebody from Oceania, and sometimes it's somebody from Europe. That's basically how it works. Now, Australia used to be in Oceania from a football point of view, but they played a match against a country called American Samoa.
Yes.
And Australia won 31-0.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Now, the Australians said, in fairness, this isn't good for American Samoa, and it's not good for Australia. We feel we should play in a different continent. And they were accepted into the Asian continent. And to be fair to Australia, there are a limited number of spaces from Asia. I think it's only six. And Australia has made it every time since it's joined Asia.
Interestingly enough, as far as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, before this World Cup started, Samoa did play Australia. They lost, but they did really well.
Yeah, but you see, Samoa has been able to play against other Pacific nations and build up its strength over the last number of years. And that's the thing. And because it hasn't been beaten 31-0 on a regular basis, they've become a better team. But of course, there's so many different Samoas. There's the independent Samoa, there's the American Samoa, and so on. And there's one called Western Samoa, and I'm not sure who runs that one. But Samoa as Samoa are quite a force in rugby. They're quite a decent rugby team. So it just goes to show, it's not a given that if it, just because the team is from Samoa, it's going to be necessarily crap. The situation is now that New Zealand are the kings of Oceania, but they're regularly vying for places in the World Cup with the likes of Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, Fiji, etc. And New Zealand regularly finishes in the slot, but because Oceania seemed to be such a weak continent, The winners of Oceania, normally New Zealand or Vanuatu or Papua New Guinea, one of them, ends up playing a playoff to decide who goes into the World Cup with, say, the fifth team from South America or the odd man out from Europe, depending on who's hosting the World Cup.
Imagine love so rare. She's is young and tender, but will life bend her? I look around, is she everywhere? She shares his wishes. I'm sure he's king, without a doubt. With love so captive, so sorely captive, I ask if I could play the part.
Okay, now if you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia, and I'm talking with our Irish correspondent Declan Hughes in Dublin, and we're going to talk about Dublin now. You mentioned to me off air that migrants in Ireland, particularly in Dublin, I think, are actually living in converted Dublin offices. Is that right?
Well, we've a massive domestic homeless crisis underpinning this. See, there was a decision made years ago. I don't know if you're old enough to remember the founding of a political party called the Progressive Democrats.
Yes, I am.
Progressive Democrats were founded, I think, shortly before you left Ireland by disaffected members of Fianna Fáil who recruited some disaffected members of Fine Gael and formed a kind of a right-wing, politically pro-capitalist, market-based party. For years, the state, and back in the days when the Irish state didn't have a pot to piss in financially. Yeah. We were building social housing. The government would erect these, buy land, erect these houses on the outskirts of towns. Places like Crumlin and Kimmage and Sallymoggin, near where you used to live.
Yes.
They're all examples of social housing. And basically, the local authority would rent out the properties to the tenants at an affordable rent, and over time, they would get back the cost of building the house from, if not your family, then the family that took over from you renting the house, the next generation, and so on and so forth. And this worked beautifully right the way through the terrible 30s, the appalling 40s, the dreadful 50s, and the 60s, when things started to get a bit more prosperous for the Irish economy. Just as a footnote to people who don't understand, the Irish population fell in every census from 1851 to 1961. And it was down as low as 2.75 million people for the entire Republic of Ireland in 1966. 1971, it hit 3 million again, and it's on the rise. In fact, Henry, we had a census last year, and the population has its highest levels since just after the famine.
Wow, it's interesting. I just want to explain to our listeners, you know, a lot of the reason, well, the main reason, I imagine, is that people emigrated to the UK, America, everywhere.
Yeah. And the reason why people emigrated is, I'm not sure if you're a good example of this, Henry, or not, but economically, our economy used to go up and down like a yo-yo. You'd have periods of relative prosperity, certainly in the 20th century, and then that'd be followed by a slump. The economy would collapse, people would lose their jobs, and people would be forced to go and look for jobs abroad. In fact, they reckon the reason that there wasn't a social revolution in Ireland is because all the revolutionaries left the country.
yes.
And in fairness, that's probably true. And those that stayed behind were content to wait for brighter days, like me, for example. Be that as it may, I would get back to where I was with the Progressive Democrats. The Progressive Democrats propped up several governments in the 80s and 90s. And during one of their periods as the minor party in office, a decision was taken to stop building social housing and to allow the market to provide. And as you and I know, Henry, capitalism has been abject in its failure to provide for anything other than profits to its directors. That's all it provides. So if they're not making enough money from building houses, they stop building houses. With the result, there is a dearth of housing stock in the country. And this happened, the decision not to build houses came at a time when we were witnessing record high immigration into the country, and also the birth rate was starting to grow again, and we were enjoying a thing called the Celtic Tiger.
Yes.
So the timing of the decision to stop building state housing was dismal in the extreme, and we're now reaping the rewards. There are up to 11,000 domestic homeless people, and we're now trying to accommodate refugees on top of that. This is why office accommodation has been converted into temporary housing for the refugees. Now, a lot of people are worried about why the fact that this wasn't done to accommodate our own homeless first, and then we'd be good at it, and then we'd be able to provide probably better standard quality accommodation for our visitors from overseas. But nevertheless, we are where we are, as that old expression goes. It's not a phrase I like to use very often, but I think it applies to this context brilliantly. Now, there's a very interesting article in the Irish Independent on over the weekend. And he identified the 10 issues that must be addressed to solve the Irish housing crisis. Now, I'll just give you the 10 issues and explain anything that you don't understand. There was a failure to provide land for homes and control its cost. The cost of land in Ireland has gone up through the roof because the population is rising, the amount of spare land is diminishing, and you can imagine how that works. That's actually how the market actually works. It doesn't work in anybody else's favour. 2, a failure to enable the conversion of existing properties. We have existing properties that are vacant. In fact, they reckon there was something like... I saw a figure somewhere that there might be up to 600,000 vacant properties in the country. If they could all be converted, we probably wouldn't need to build a single house for anybody. Things like, for example, you know those old shops that you would have seen when you were growing up at Dunleary, and there'd be an apartment above it?
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of those are vacant at the moment.
Why?
Nobody seems to know. Letting ideology get in the way of proper social housing provision. That gets back to the Progressive Democrats, because they were in power with both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil during the 90s, and their poison of not building houses basically got implemented. And I think history is going to be very unkind to them when they're looked back on. The over-privatization of the housing market. There's a thing called the housing assistance payment, which is paid to people who are on low income to help them afford to rent accommodation. And the state forks out about $1 billion a year on this. Certain landlords won't accept you if you're a HAP payment tenant. If you're receiving HAP payment, they won't rent to you.
Can these immigrants, can they go on the dole?
No. You see, this is the problem. They can't. When they arrive here, they're put in a thing called direct provision, whereby they're put usually up in hotels. They're fed and watered, and they're given 19 quid a week spending money. They're not legal here, you see, so they can't. The refugees are not legal here. Until you're legally resident in the country.
So they're illegal immigrants.
They're technically illegal immigrants. But because of the fact they're here as refugees and their application for refugee status is being processed, they're kind of in this limbo. Yeah. And it's very for them to get involved in the community. The only people, members of the community that are allowed to get involved in the community are basically the kids. The kids are able to go to local schools. But here's the kicker, Henry. They find themselves in the community. They settle in. They get to know their neighbours and so on. And they're there for about 2 or 3 years. And all of a sudden, the lease on the hotel they've been put up in is up. And then they're moved 60 miles away or 100 miles away to another part of the country. And they have to rebuild their lives all over again. And that's very, very unfair on the refugees. And it's also very unfair on the communities that hosted them and accepted them and took them into their hearts and were willing to allow them to live amongst them as community members once they got their status sorted. It's like you're giving me a new friend and then you're taking him away from me, you know?
Yeah.
That's the locals feel. I got to know Farouk Brook, and he's a nice guy, and I like his wife and I like his kids. And all of a sudden, because the hotel lease is up, you're fucking him 50 miles down the road?
That's really dreadful. There's also a language barrier, obviously, when they go to Ireland. And the other thing to point out is the refugees, they're coming from very unstable environments, unstable countries. It must be very hard for them with the language barrier.
They try to provide them with English classes, in fairness, but the kids are the breakthrough, because the kids go to school and learn the language and they go home and teach their parents.
It's a common thing throughout the ages that, you know, if you look at, you know, the recent situation with Russia in Ukraine, and you see Russians being interviewed or young Ukrainians being interviewed, they know English very well, but their parents don't speak a word of English, you know?
Yeah. And that's a major difficulty. Now, I mean, again, if the correct structures are put in place, things can be addressed. We have, for example, you probably don't know this, and I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before. We have a school of Slavonic languages in Ranelagh.
Oh, that's where I went to school.
You can go to this school of Slavonic languages. You can learn Polish. You can learn Croatian. Here's a secret, folks. If you learn Croatian, you're also learning Serbian, Bosnian, and Montenegrin, because they're the same language.
Perfect.
I did a course with a tape and a cassette tape and a Walkman and a book in 1999. I taught myself Serbo-Croatian for 3 months, every day on the bus on the way in and the way home.
Wow.
And I learned four languages for the price of one. I'm made up, I am.
That's
anyway,
fantastic.
But this school exists. So the expertise is there to help these people communicate, and you could teach them English. And you can, in fact, if you got a few of them that were good at teaching, you can get them to teach Irish people their languages.
Hmm.
Yeah, there must be somebody among the Ukrainian refugee community that could become a Ukrainian teacher in the School for Slavonic Studies. There has to be somebody.
I just want to get back to the fact that these are refugees. So they can't legally work. Obviously, they can't get the dole. You've told me that.
They work until they're made legal. And there's so many people...
But they would be working illegally, like, you know, which happens, you know, in the United States of America. Latinos or people who are illegal immigrants, they get cash-only jobs, and there must be some of that going on, Declan.
There isn't that much of it going on, to be fair. Yeah. Once you're in the system, it's very hard for you to do something illegal like that, because you're afraid you'll be deported.
Yes, and that must be a scary thought.
And this government has a hefty track record on deportation. I know a chap who was born in New Zealand. Now, he's one generation too far removed to qualify for Irish citizenship through ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
He studied here in Dublin City University. I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to get him into trouble. Mm. But he studied here at Dublin City University and befriended a chap who was a regular on my radio show for years. So again, I don't want to mention his name either.
Yes.
But anyway, he outstayed his study visa in Dublin by 6 months. His passport was stamped persona non grata, and he can never return to Ireland.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Right. I want to get back to these offices for the moment. You know, we've had a pandemic, still have a pandemic, even though the media pretends it's all in the past. Is this conversion of offices for these refugees, is that connected to the fact that a lot of people started working from home and many did not go back? Or has it got any relationship with that fact?
In some cases, it does have a very hefty relationship with that fact. In some cases, it doesn't. The fact is, a lot of office blocks were built in anticipation of a demand for office space happening. What we've seen happen is we've seen people move out of offices to other locations and so on. The one that I think you're referring to is the one in East Wall. Now, East Wall is already a multicultural community.
Yeah.
They built a lot of apartments in the East Wall area. And in fact, locals, the reason I'm familiar with East Wall is because our radio station used to be located on East Wall Road.
Right.
We relocated earlier this year. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time down there. And you get if you travel on the 53 bus, which is one of the local buses down there, you'd strike a conversation with people. And I struck a conversation with this very nice old lady one time. And she was saying that her children wanted to move into new accommodation in East Wall, and that the demand for the rental accommodation in East Wall was so expensive, and made the rent so expensive that these kids who grew up in East Wall couldn't afford to live in East Wall anymore.
Gosh. I remember, you know, back in the 70s, I visited one of those, you know, huge blocks with you know, people were just stuck in these horrible blocks in the city. Massive buildings, these people, a lot of them were on the dole, a lot of them were, you know, lower, I hate using that term, but socioeconomic situation. I was fascinated because I'd never been in one of these blocks before, and it was just huge, and the flats were tiny, and I just thought, this is the wrong way to do this, building these massive blocks. And I think they changed it, Declan, where...
I live in an apartment now, Henry.
Yes.
It's floors high. There's three apartments on each floor.
How many floors high, sorry, Declan?
Four.
Four floors, okay.
Yeah. Now, most of the apartments in my area are four floors, but there's one that's only three, so it only has nine apartments in it.
Right.
It's livable. There's a lot of density for the space that it takes up. And my apartment block is a multicultural one. My neighbour's next door from Argentina.
That'd be the other lady, very suitable for you, Declan.
The other lady on the floor is Irish, and I've never met her. The only reason I know she's Irish is there's a parcel outside her door the last 3 years, and I just had an earwig to see what her name was. Yes. I've never met her.
No.
The neighbours I know best on the floor are the lady who represents the apartment block with the management group. We have an estate management group, and we pay a fee to look after, you know, the facilities.
Yeah.
I represent. I know her quite well. And I know her husband and her kids. And there is a lad from Mauritius upstairs as well. There's a very nice family from Nigeria. There's a man and his wife and three daughters. And there's a Romanian chap who we bonded over football. And he works on Sunday mornings. And I literally got to know him walking to the bus stop one Sunday morning. His first name is Elvis, incidentally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and he's from Romania. So I have neighbors from Romania, from Mauritius, Nigeria, Argentina, and that's just the ones I know. I know the neighbors on the ground floor by sight to say hello to, but I just judging by what I've spoken to them, I think most of them are Irish. But I'm literally on the first floor. So there's three neighbors on the first floor. On this floor, it's two Irish, I think, and the Argentinians, and then it's a mixed bag all the way up. In 12 flats.
That's fantastic. I love that. And as I've often said to you on this broadcast, I, you know, like yourself, grew up in Dublin. And at that time, there were no immigrants at all. There was one guy called Nicky Ginadu in our primary school in Ranelagh, in Dublin. And that was it. And then I didn't go back from Australia to Ireland for the whole of the 90s. I was never in Ireland for the 90s. Went back in 2001. I was very surprised. And, you know, going into a fast food place, you'd see Indian people behind. Yeah. I mean, it was really kind of, I mean, it was shocking for me, but in a nice way, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, somebody once said to me, why are you still single? And I said, because we didn't have immigration in the 1970s.
Oh, dear. Well, look, I guess we got to go. Declan, thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes International. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Henry.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. What on earth am I meant to
sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.